Generation walk slowly, resting on the benches they watch the world go by. There's a man who cycles through daily, perched steadily on his bike, in his kurta pajama. A topi sits proudly on his head, and his splendid long black beard never moves with the wind as he passes. One time, I watched a group of women all in black walking at speed with purpose, united in rhythm against the blustery weather as the wind carried the sound of their Gujarati. It filled up their burkas like big, fat, round balloons. They were like a flock of birds about to take off. They headed off towards Shrewsbury Street Community Centre, built on the road where Lowry's childhood house was. He was born here on the 1st of November, 1887, at number 8 Barrett Street. He must have walked, maybe even played here, my park, as a toddler, watching the changes of the seasons, as I am doing now. He too had to come to terms with losing a father at a young age, deal with the sudden lack of money, the forced reversals of his family's fortunes. He moved with his mother to Pendlebury, still in Salford, but now he was amongst factories with smoke-filled chimneys, in the streets with no trees or greenery. Later, he said of Pendlebury,
"At first I detested it, and then, after years, I got pretty interested in it, then obsessed by it."
The subjects for his paintings were on his doorstep and on mine. In later life, he recalled this as a sort of vision.
"One day, I missed a train from Pendlebury, a place I had ignored for 7 years. And as I left the station, I saw the Acme Spinning Company's mill. The huge black framework of rows of yellow-lit windows standing up against the sad, damp-charged afternoon sky. The mill was turning out. I watched this scene, which I'd looked at many times without seeing, with rapture."
Lowry worked as the rent collector for a property company. He did not tell people about his work, not wanting to be known as a spare-time painter. But he never gave up his day job, which took him walking all over this city. He made his way through the parks, going from estate to estate, as his new surroundings went through the changes with the Blitz, rebuilding, slum clearances, new housing, his observations captured on canvas. Just a few years before Lowry's work, open spaces in Salford were disappearing with urban development. In 1883, the MP for Bury had spoken in Parliament about the lack of areas for public recreation in his hometown. There were even letters in the Times on the subject.
10th of July, 1846. "Sir, what is the use of excessive exclusiveness with regard to parks which used to be considered public? It is enough to make any person's blood boil to see a well-dressed mechanic refused permission into a park considered public. I wish, sir, you would either enlighten me on the subject or attempt some improvement of the aristocratic notions of the men in green."
As a result, the Select Committee on Public Walks reached the conclusion that a place was needed for ordinary people to go to on rest days, in open air and with greenery to relax in. The most prominent supporters of this were the Liberal MP for Manchester, Mark Phillips, and the then Prime Minister, Sir Robert Peel. So, Peel Park in Salford was one of the first public parks to open in England, a glorious space. Several parks were bought for public use in Lowry's lifetime. Even today, there are 20 public parks in Salford. That's over 60% of the city. Lowry has these parks in his paintings again and again. My favourite is the bandstand. It captures Peel Park full of people. In its centre is the bandstand crowded with musicians playing to the workers, circles of them dancing to the music. The movement of the dancers going round, the celebration is there in the dancing loops, surrounded by audiences watching, wishing, swaying. It's a moment caught, how the parks were, the ordinary places ordinary folk went to be. His matchstick men and women promenading, enjoying. Lowry painted not just what he saw, but the future in his painting. It is then now and what will be Salford. I am walking here in Buell Hill Park, a long way from my childhood memories. Yet this is where I belong, feel at home, celebrating the proms in the park. People with picnics, loved ones. There is music, laughter, open air. Lowry's Salford, a different century. The rituals remain unchanged.
Park Life was presented by Andrew Malik and was produced by Rebecca Stratford. The reader was Sean Baker. The Proms in the Park events will be celebrating the last night of the Proms on Saturday in Buell Hill Park in Salford and also in London, Hillsborough, Swansea and Dundee. More details on the website. But let me welcome you back to the Royal Albert Hall here on BBC Radio 3. I'm Katie Derham and you join me for a prom which is perhaps the biggest celebration yet of Schumann's bicentenary. Don't forget you can listen again via the website for the next 7 days. And if you are logged in now, you might want to use a new service we're trying out. It's the extra high quality audio stream. You'll see there's a little box you can click on the homepage of the website. It's an experiment, so do please give us your feedback. But back to the music now. And having heard that wonderful introduction and Allegro Appassionato by Schumann just before the interval, it's time now for a new work by Robin Holloway, inspired by and built around, if you like, some of the last songs that Schumann wrote. They were set to texts written by Mary, Queen of Scots. And tonight's conductor, Gianandrea Noseda, thought they'd make a very good basis for an orchestral work. The man asked to take it on was Robin Holloway, a huge fan of Schumann's music. Born in Leamington Spa in 1943, he had an epiphany as a young composer in the early 70s. He'd been writing music the way he'd been taught to, at Cambridge and at Oxford, which he describes as grey and dreary. The music, that is, not the towns. But then he discovered Schumann and immediately wrote his orchestral scenes from Schumann and fantasy pieces on Schumann's Liederkreis. He'd found his voice and it was the start of a prolific career. And he compares the epiphany to stumbling on an old Roman road and realising that this was the way across this landscape that used to be used, that everyone understood and everyone went that way. And he continues, now I can go that way too. Might be a bit overgrown, but it's still the most direct way between two points. Interesting stuff. Earlier, he told us how he approached the Mary, Queen of Scots commission.
I think most lovers of the great Schumann would say this is not one of his happiest works, you know. OK, it's very unhappy in its subject matter, I don't mean that. I mean, it's not very lovely music and it certainly doesn't breathe freely that incredible lyricism of his youth. They're very claustrophobic and obsessional, in the way that all late Schumann is, because that was part of his problem, of his failing powers. But then you think, Mary Queen of Scots, imprisoned, her life under threat. So claustrophobia and limitation and circularity are in fact rather expressive here. And Schumann obviously identified with her in his own virtually imprisoned situation and the sense of, you know, being at the end of his tether somehow. Just to orchestrate it wouldn't have interested me. So I asked if I could amplify the work by at least enclosing it between a prologue and an epilogue, which would open out the material and open out the locked-in emotion, and possibly little numbers between some of the songs, little entr'actes. Fortunately, the BBC bought that idea, and I did it with increasing interest and fascination. The result is a portrait of Mary, Queen of Scots, in the moods inside the songs. Some moods not there at all, like happiness, like looking back to childhood, looking back to her happy days in France, but looking forward equally beyond the songs to her end that we know about, that she doesn't. So it's a portrait of her in many aspects.
Robin Holloway describing this piece to us a little earlier this afternoon. There are 5 songs that he's written around and arranged, as he explained there. And the 5 songs are these: Farewell to France, After the Birth of Her Son, To Queen Elizabeth, then Farewell to the World, and finally Prayer. We're going to hear them performed by the BBC Philharmonic with German soprano Dorothea Rüschmann. She made her debut at the 1995 Salzburg Festival as Susanna in The Marriage of Figaro with Nikolaus Harnoncourt, and she has not looked back since. She's soon to appear as the Marschallin in Der Rosenkavalier for Berlin State Opera and Countess Almaviva for Paris Opera and Vienna State Opera. She's won prizes and plaudits for her recordings of Schumann's songs. Well, as we await both our soloist and our conductor, Gianandrea Nozeda, tonight, it's worth talking a little bit more about Maestro Nozeda and his relationship with the BBC Philharmonic, which, as I said earlier, is a very close and warm one, which actually will be coming to a close at the end of next season, towards the end of next year. But that round of applause there is for Gianandrea Nozeda and for soloist Dorothea Rüschmann, who will be singing Robin Holloway's Reliquary, a setting of songs by Schumann set to the text of Mary, Queen of Scots.
Thank you.
Robin Holloway's Reliquary, a new arrangement and framework around Schumann's very last songs. Performed there by Dorothea Rösmann with the BBC Philharmonic and conducted by Gianandrea Nozeda. And composer Robin Holloway is now making his way to the stage to take his bow. It's not the first time his work has been performed here at the Proms, but having spoken to him at the interval, I know he was so looking forward to hearing the interpretation of Gianandrea Nozeda, Dorothea Rösmann, and the BBC Philharmonic this evening, and he seems extremely delighted by the reaction he's getting. The songs, of course, written to texts by the doomed Mary, Queen of Scots, so different from Schumann's earlier outpourings of wonderful Lieder written when he was at his happiest, just married to Clara Wieck, Here, later in his life, he clearly identified with the despair of Mary Stuart, and one writer, an expert on Schumann's songs, said we can only conjecture what personal meaning he found in these writings. The first begins, I am going away. The last ends, save me. And soon after he'd written the music to these texts came his mental breakdown, his attempt to drown himself in the Rhine, and his incarceration in the asylum at Endenich, where in July 1856 he died. A somber theme, but a wonderful work, written by Robin Holloway, setting and arranging and adding to those songs by Schumann. And Robin's back on the stage now, thanking the orchestra. Steve Bernard, the viola player, is getting special thanks from both conductor and composer. And now the whole orchestra on their feet again. And warm thanks from the composer to the soloist, Dorothea Rösmann, who sang those songs so beautifully. A world premiere here at the Commons. Now, as the orchestra retunes and the stage is tidied up, we can look forward to the last piece of tonight's prom, the work that Schumann called full of Grecian lightness and grace, Mozart's Symphony No. 40 in G minor. It's the middle of the trilogy of symphonies he composed in the space of just 3 months in the summer of 1788, and it's one that always makes a great impact on his listeners, though it does seem to defy description. One critic says he heard the agitation of passion, the regrets of an unhappy love. Another says it's heroically tragic, and both those views seem to contrast with Schumann's. But perhaps that is the magic of Mozart, as tonight's conductor Gianandrea Noseda told me earlier.
Great symphony. Sometimes when you have a very famous piece, the risk is, as a performer, to lose the surprise element, because you know the symphony since you were 6, 7 years old. But actually, the symphony is so good, every single time I go back to the score, I find literally 3, 4, 5 new elements, which I've never seen before. So it's incredible. So this is a signal of a great piece of music. When you go back, you think, oh, I know it, and you discover you don't know it yet. You have to spend more time to get closer to that music. And with this symphony, and in general with modern music, is often the case.
Gianandrea Noseda talking to me earlier. Now, let's put it in the context of Mozart's short but incredibly prolific life. He'd made the move to Vienna from Salzburg 7 years before he wrote this symphony. He'd already given us The Marriage of Figaro and Don Giovanni, which he wrote with the fabulously rakish ex-priest Lorenzo del Ponte, but he still hadn't got round to Così fan tutti. At this stage, he was still extremely popular. He was probably still suffering from his usual chaotic money troubles. His writing by now was at new heights of textural richness and emotional depth. Extraordinary period of creativity. The 40th Symphony has a wonderful opening, quite an unusual one for the time, as the accompaniment precedes the tune, but then, oh, Wolfgang, always the revolutionary. As with so much of his work, there is a seemingly boundless range of musical meanings, but he brings them together in an ever-changing but completely coherent whole. The BBC Philharmonic, of course, enjoying their annual visit to the Proms under their beloved Gianandrea Noseda, their chief conductor. As I mentioned earlier, it's actually almost his last season with them. He's going to be moving on to wonderful new work. And there is a conductor in waiting, the conductor designate, the Spanish conductor Juanjo Mena. He'll be beginning his tenure in the 2011-2012 season. Next season's highlight, there will be a concert performance of Verdi's Otello, which will be Gianandrea Noseda's last concert in his current role. This year has been dominated by the Mahler in Manchester Festival, which was staged in collaboration with the city's other orchestras as well. They've had a very busy time. They're about to move house as well. Next year, the BBC Philharmonic moves to a state-of-the-art rehearsal studio at Media City UK in nearby Salford, joining other departments at the BBC's new Northern Hub. I hear it's all looking rather good. They've had a sneak preview. So a very happy time for the orchestra. And here is their conductor, Gianandrea Noseda, back on stage now to conduct Mozart's Symphony No. 40 in G minor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mozart's Symphony No. 40 in G minor. A stormy allegro rocketing along that last movement there. Energetic performance by the BBC Philharmonic Orchestra under Gian Andrea Noseda. Conducting that piece without a baton, he's conducted much of this prom without a baton actually, drawing the sound out of the BBC Philharmonic with his hands. What a delicate fingertip conducting going on, very balletic actually, standing in front of the orchestra. And sometimes almost dancing, indeed, in front of the orchestra as well. He's coming back into the stage now to bring his BBC Philharmonic Orchestra, led today by guest leader Helena Wood, to their feet. And he's shaking almost every member of the orchestra personally by the hand. Mozart's 40th, a piece loved by Schumann, the composer being celebrated here tonight and indeed throughout this season of the Proms during his bicentennial year. Tonight we heard music by him, music inspired by him, and music enjoyed by him. And as Gian Andrea Noseda leaves the stage once more and the BBC Philharmonic take their seats again, it is time for me to say goodnight, but also to remind you that there is, of course, another prom tomorrow, just one, Monteverdi's Vespers of 1610, with the Monteverdi Choir and English Baroque soloists, conducted by Sir John Eliot Gardner. Should be a wonderful evening, and you will, of course, be able to hear that live here on BBC Radio 3. I will be back on Saturday on BBC 2 and then indeed on BBC 1 for the last night of the proms. What a night. I do hope you'll join me then. But for now, it is time to hand you back to my colleague John Shea in Broadcasting House.
Thank you, Katie. That was Katie Derham at the Royal Albert Hall. And remember that the Proms website invites you to submit your own reviews of any concert in the season. It also has details, of course, of all of the Proms in the Park events taking place on the last night this coming Saturday. That all happens at bbc.co.uk/proms. So tomorrow afternoon, there's another chance to hear last Saturday's concert by the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra and Sir Simon Rattle, with Carita Mattala singing the Strauss Four Last Songs. That's from 2:20 tomorrow afternoon. And then, as we've just heard, tomorrow night, the Royal Albert Hall from 7:30 will be resounding to the music of Monteverdi. Deus tu. Et corona premium laudes cadentes martiri absolve ex Vesper Hymn for the Feast of a Martyr, music by Monteverdi from his collection Selva Morale e Spirituale, published in 1641. That was Deus Tuorum Militum. I dare say you may have recognised the voices singing it there, the soprano Emma Kirkby, the tenor Ian Partridge and the bass David Thomas, with the parley of instruments directed by Roy Goodman and Peter Holman. And let me remind you once again of tomorrow night's prom, Monteverdi's Vespers of 1610, conducted by Sir John Eliot Gardiner at 7:30 tomorrow evening. Well, back to this evening on Radio 3 with Beethoven Cello Sonata in 45 minutes, performed by one of Radio 3's new generation artists. And then at 11 o'clock, tonight's essay continues our series looking at the meeting of the land, sea and sky. Tonight, it's the turn of the poet Jeremy Hooker, who grew up on the Solent shore and later lived and worked overlooking Cardigan Bay. The essay, tonight on Radio 3 at 11 o'clock. But now, at a little after 9:45, it's time for our feature, Tracking the Aryans. The word Aryan has a long and recently a troubled history, becoming associated with the Nazis' ideology of a blonde, blue-eyed master race. In the Bronze Age, it was a name used by societies in Iran, Pakistan and northern India. But by the 19th century, it had another meaning, referring to the speakers of the prehistoric language Proto-Indo-European, the ancient mother tongue of many languages of Europe and Asia. Well, today the word's negative connotations mean that it's generally avoided. But recent archaeological discoveries on the remote borders of Siberia and Kazakhstan have brought the Aryans to renewed attention. Now on Radio 3, the historian Bettany Hughes journeys to Siberia to see how the discoveries are changing our understanding of prehistory. And she finds out how, even today, the Aryans are being used for modern political ends.
I can honestly say that I have never before travelled on a road like this one. Even though I am a bit bleary, because I flew in from Moscow late last night and then was woken by the brilliance of a blood-orange dawn over the Caspian Sea, I can appreciate the sheer vastness of what lies ahead of me. To the north are the Ural Mountains and to the south, Kazakhstan. But what lies east, and that's the direction that we're travelling in, are just thousands and thousands of miles of steppe grassland, which basically carry on until you hit the Pacific Ocean. And in those grasslands, there's a time bomb. It's an archaeological dig of the very distant past that's being used to politicise and to reconfigure the present. For me, this is a journey that goes way beyond my comfort zone. I'm used to sniffing out evidence of societies through their artefacts and records, right back to the late Bronze Age. But in the terms of written texts, as we travel back beyond 1600 BC, the trail that I'm following today starts to go rather cold. And that is frustrating, because although written words themselves might be conspicuous by their absence, the settlement that I'm heading towards could be a missing link that directs us right back to the origins of the language that you and I speak, a linguistic code that's shared by just over 50% of the world's population today. What I'm seeking out is half of humanity's original mother tongue, Proto-Indo-European.
The question of the origins of our language has always been more than just antiquarian curiosity. For some, the logic goes that if we can find the speakers of an ancient tongue that gave birth to the languages spoken by the great cultures of Europe, the Middle East and India, then we find those who could rightly claim to be the fathers of civilization. The search for linguistic ancestry has, as a result, been tenacious and highly charged. Over the last 200 years, Linguists have demonstrated that the majority of the languages spoken from Ireland all the way to India are part of one linguistic family. English, Greek, Farsi, Sanskrit, Hittite from Anatolia, Tocharian from Western China are all close cousins, all descended from one mainspring tongue. Known today as Proto-Indo-European, its identification begged the question, why was this tongue a Darwinian victor, a language that was somehow strong and fit enough to survive and to propagate? A series of new archaeological excavations on the remote borders of southern Siberia and Kazakhstan may possibly offer up some answers. This region is now being described as the land of the cities, because here the discovery of a series of sophisticated prehistoric settlements, and there may be as many as 20 or so, is rewriting the history of civilization. My destination was one of the most intriguing sites. A city that flourished 36 centuries ago. A place called Ar-Qa'im.
So we've been on the road for 7.5 hours and at last we've arrived. It's all slightly disorientating because so far we've driven past a huge mural of Lenin, a derelict windmill, some yurts, and I can hear this strange sound of chanting coming up from the valley. But luckily I've been invited to stay with Professor Stanovic, who's the chief archaeologist here. Hello, Professor. I arrived at Ar-Qa'im on the day before the summer solstice, and I didn't quite know what to expect. Little has been published about the site, and I'd also heard rumblings of strange goings-on here at this time of year.
Take my shoes off, Russian style, OK?
Yes, yes.
OK, the shoes are going off. Lovely to meet you. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you.
The professor was keen I shouldn't be drawn to distractions such as distant chanting, and he steered me straight to his archaeological discoveries.
It was 23 years ago, to the very day, that this site was discovered. Do you still remember that moment, Professor?
Я очень хорошо помню. Дело в том, что
I remember it clearly.
Это рассказать сложно.
In the year of 1987, there were construction works here taking place, and they were planning to erect here a river reservoir. A group of our young scientists came here because they knew that the construction works were planned, and they started excavating. There was an airport nearby. The students went up to the sky, took this picture, aerial picture, and suddenly we saw circles here on the land. And at that very moment, Professor knew that it was the Bronze Age. 3 months later, this territory was to be covered with water. Professor took this photograph and went by airplane to Leningrad, St. Petersburg now, so to Professor
Petrovsky.
And Petrovsky had the same reaction to that of Professor Zdanovich. Petrovsky just stopped and made a telephone call to Gorbachev. And in a week, the sky here was full of airplanes, helicopters, and the special commission of the Soviet Ministry, as well as the Academy of Science.
What they'd found was breathtaking. Dated between 2000 and 1600 BC, here was a fortified town laid out in a complex circular form, 200 metres across. A 5-metre-high earth wall with timber gates protected 50 to 60 houses inside. The inhabitants, 2,000 or so of them, left behind intriguing remains. Finely worked copper jewellery, makeup and tattooing equipment, diningware, complex burials, and, crucially, evidence of the earliest known chariot technology. One element absent from the archaeological record, though, was the language spoken by the men and women as they built a life for themselves here.
Indrasya hardyaha vishanne Indrasya sobaradhase shampavastva vitarshane Prajavadreta abhara.
These words could offer a clue. They're lines from one of the oldest surviving texts in any Indo-European language, the Rig Veda of ancient India, composed by a Bronze Age people who seem to have called themselves Aryans. For us, Aryan has become a loaded term, but of course, as archaeologist David Anthony explains, the very last thing we should associate it with is a blonde, blue-eyed master race.
There is another sense of the word Aryan, which is the Aryans of actual prehistory. There really were Aryans, people who referred to themselves as Aryans. The name of the country, Iran, is a version of the word Aryan. And in Iran was the origin of the religion which we call Zoroastrianism. And Zoroastrianism goes back to a religious document called the Avesta, the oldest document in Iranian. And the oldest parts of the Avesta were composed by people who called themselves Aryans. So there are the Aryans of the Avesta. And the Aryans who composed the oldest parts of the Avesta, probably about 1200 BC, were related to other Aryans who composed the religious documents that are at the root of Hinduism. The composers of the Rig Veda also referred to themselves as Aryans. So the Aryans of the Rig Veda and the Aryans of the Avesta were real people, but they lived in what is today Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, northern India, between 1500 and 1000 BC. You can really refer to those Aryans and you're talking about real people. But they should not be confused with the Aryans of propaganda who exist only in the minds of nationalists and politicians and racists.
What are we walking along now? We seem to be striding out through the grass and the shrub.
We are now going along the outer wall of Akraim, and it's about 1 meter high over the steppe. In ancient times, it would be about 5 meters high.
So it's a fortified settlement. But who is it protecting? Who's living here?
Indo-European people used to live here. Their old perception is reflected in the burials. That is, chariots which were put, sacrifices, and so on. And it can be also reflected in Rig Veda texts.
Tell me how you equate the two, because the Rig Veda texts are obviously very ancient hymns. What reflection of those do you see in the archaeology here?
Rig Veda texts were written by poets, and they had special rituals, and they sang hymns to gods. We find these rituals, and we excavate the traces of these rituals of the natural form, the way they were.
That's so fascinating. So what you're saying is that you can see the myths and the stories of the religious texts made flesh in the archaeology that you're digging up here at Akraim.
That's
it. One of the traditions that's continued absolutely unchanged in this region is a love of horses, of horse racing, and of riding in chariots and wagons. And because of that, I've been offered a lift by a man who's turned up clearly because of the midsummer solstice activities here, hoping to try to tout for a bit of custom, and he's given me a ride along the steps. It's actually immensely appropriate because what he probably doesn't realise is that the first ever extant chariot was discovered very close to here, and it dates back to around 2000 BC. And so we know from the archaeology that the culture that lived here were very fond of their horses. In fact, when a great man died, his horse would be sacrificed and buried with him along with the chariot. Now, what's fascinating is that that practice, which we're finding hard evidence of in the archaeology, matches up exactly with lines from the Rig Veda. Just listen to this. This is Rig Veda 1:162.
keep the limbs undamaged and place them in the proper pattern. Cut those limbs of the horse apart, calling out piece by piece. And then once the animal was killed, the flesh would be distributed amongst those around. Those who see that the racehorse is cooked, who say, it smells good, take it away, and who wait for the doling out of the flesh of the charger, they are glad. And then this ceremony will be finished off with grand prayers. Let us speak great words as men of power in the sacrificial gathering. It's just so tantalising because we cannot yet be sure that that language that they used was indeed the direct ancestor of the words that I'm speaking today. Trying to tally fragmentary archaeology with a remote language is, of course, precarious. Plenty of opportunity to turn a possibility into a certainty. Pitfalls ever-present, it seems, when it comes to tracking Aryans. David Anthony.
In the 19th century, as European nations were trying to make themselves, some of them began to adopt the idea that they were descended from the original speakers of Proto-Indo-European, and they made a mistake and identified the original speakers of Proto-Indo-European as Aryans. And they did this largely because the Vedas and the Avesta were newly discovered. They were just being translated into Western languages. They were objects of fascination. People talked about them in their parlors, in Victorian homes. There were articles about these new texts in 19th century newspapers and popular literature. And the name Aryan was attached to these Eastern texts, the Avesta and the Rig Veda. And because it was popular, that name became applied to the people who spoke Proto-Indo-European, the original language from which all of the Indo-European languages are descended. But in fact, the Aryan languages, the Indo-Iranian languages, are a daughter. They are not the mother. Nevertheless, the mistake was made in the popular literature, so the Aryans of propaganda were born in that way and were regarded as the ultimate source from which all Indo-European languages descended, something that all linguists of the time realized was an error.
There may have been confusion about who the Aryans were, but the study of texts such as the Avesta and the Rig Veda catalyzed a revolution in linguistics. It meant that the search for the speakers of Proto-Indo-European wasn't just done via excavations, but by a kind of archaeology on the language itself. James Mallory of Queen's University Belfast explains how.
One reconstructs by comparing words in the different languages and the grammars of the different languages, so that when you find, for example, we say a BH in Sanskrit, for example, in the word bratar, which means brother, we will find an F in Latin, which gives us our word frater, for example. In English, of course, it is brother, and it's the same word. And if you went through a list of the commonest terms, like kinship and things like that, you would see immediately at least a surface resemblance between even English, modern English, and ancient Sanskrit, or many of the other ancient languages of the Indo-European world. And the fact of the matter is that the reason why these words are similar is because they derive from this common language. Now, getting back to the common language, what the linguist does is they establish the rules between each of the different Indo-European languages. It produces a ballpark reconstruction of what the word might have originally sounded like. One of the things I think linguists have, you know, always imagined in the back of their heads is that if they had a phrase book written in Proto-Indo-European and they were thrown back something like 5,000 years, what chance would they have of making themselves understood? I suspect that most of them imagine badly, but they might just about get the ideas across.
Time travel might not be a possibility, but an actual journey to Central Asia today does help you to imagine how those snatches of Proto-Indo-European that have been identified could have evolved. In a pastoral culture where men and women drove their herds through this continuous landscape, it makes perfect sense that a code of behaviour had to be developed. If you saw another group of humans appearing as tiny dots in the distance, your options were either to destroy them or to try to deal with them peaceably. And it seems that the early Bronze Age communities here plumped for the latter. Linguists tell us that around 4,000 to 5,000 years ago, an important concept was nurtured here. It was an ethical code, if you like, gusti, a notion that gives us both the words guest and host. Gusti also endures through to the Greek world as xenia, Homer's guest-host friendship. And it was a vital factor in the survival of all cultures in the Bronze Age. Basically, it meant that when you travelled, when you met strangers, you could presume that they were friends and not foe. And that allowed for men and women to exchange ideas and experiences. It allowed civilization itself to thrive. And just a little point of information. We remember gusti today not just in our originally interchangeable words of guest and host, but also in the word ghost. Because, of course, a ghost is a visitor, someone that can either be appreciated or a visitor who is slightly less welcome.
The reconstructions give us other hints about the speakers of Proto-Indo-European. Archaeologist David Anthony.
We know that they were violent at times. There's quite a bit of reconstructed vocabulary referring to violence and fighting. We know that they had institutions built around hospitality. We know that their gods inhabited the sky. Most of them were male. They seem to have had a principal deity who was referred to as Father Heaven or Father Sky, and is the basis for the Roman god Jupiter and the Greek god Zeus. They had another god who was seen as related to war and thunder, which is the basis for Thor, for instance, in Germanic mythology. And they had another god, which was the divine twins, a dual deity, who are associated with good luck and good fortune and finding the way of people or animals who are lost.
Without even leaving the library, the linguists seem able to make discoveries that archaeologists dream of. But not everyone agrees on how much you can read into reconstructed words. James Mallory.
Normally, the more interesting the term, the more controversial the reconstruction is going to be. For example, we can reconstruct certainly in a number of European languages, and we believe, or many people believe, that you can also use Sanskrit here to reconstruct the word for king. Now, the problem is, what does that mean in terms of a prehistoric society? We know what rex means in ancient Latin, or rix in the Celtic language of ancient Gaul, but what that might have meant several thousand years before that as a word, we find it very difficult to know precisely what that might mean. Because some of the things that you're going to be reconstructing may have existed in Proto-Indo-European, and some of the things may be just the generic developments that we might expect among any group of people.
Back at Archaim, there's further evidence that teasing out meaning from across the centuries is a perilous business. The prehistoric inhabitants here may not have developed the written word, but they did leave us one particularly potent symbol, the so-called swastika. Now tarnished by its Nazi appropriation as a symbol of an Aryan master race, this was in fact a sign of the sun that can be found in Bronze Age sites all over India, China, the Middle East and Southern Europe.
Elements of swastika in Archaim, безусловно, есть.
There are some elements of swastikas here. And he says that there are some settlements which were built according to the swastik shape.
I know that the swastika is this very ancient symbol. It's a very ancient religious symbol. Is that why you think these settlements are being built in that shape for some kind of ritual purpose?
It is
undoubtful. It goes without saying So that this symbol was very important for those times.
Вы знаете, свастика – это вершина символического мышления человека.
Swastics was a symbol, it was a top of mythological philosophy. That is, it's something that means the unity between man and nature, something that we really lack nowadays.
Do you think that some people come to Akureyri, like this weekend, for the Summer Solstice Festival, for the wrong reasons, that they come because swastikas are everywhere, and that's somehow feeding a political anger, rather than them coming and understanding it as an ancient religious symbol?
This fact cannot be excluded, as so many people are coming here. But he says that worldwide, archaeology attracts a lot of people nowadays, and people of different religions. That's why there could be...
We're just back from the site of Arkaim, and we were looking at the remains well into the dark. It's clear that the professor's obsession and his life's work is understanding the Bronze Age archaeology here. But also, he's well aware that he's dealing with very charged material. Because there were swastikas found here, both around the site and actually within it, on the pots of the people who lived here, it is going to be impossible to keep this kind of archaeology absolutely remote from contemporary politics. And there's hard evidence of that fact in the site's museum. The museum's been recently renovated, and up at the top of the rather fine marble stairs here, there's a huge poster showing Putin looking at a... Is that a Bronze Age pot that he's looking at?
Yeah.
And our politicians were much interested in it.
Why did they come here?
Medvedev... Он был здесь в апреле 2005 года.
President Medvedev was here in April of 2005.
Да, он не говорил, что они с Владимиром Владимировичем Путиным, они
together with Владимир Путин have meals together quite often. However complicated the day was, all their conversations always ended in where we should lead Russia, where Russia should be guided. And what kind of idea should be to unite this movement? And professor supposes that that is why they came here.
Do you know what an impact it had on Putin coming here? Do you know how it affected his thinking?
После его посещения я слышал несколько высказываний.
After his visit to Arkham, Professor Zdanovich heard some of his speeches, that is Putin's speeches when he was in India, and he was saying that according to the opinion of some scientists, India and Russia are united by some common roots.
Вы задали очень сложный вопрос.
We are aiming at.
Но это просвещение наших лидеров.
At educating our leaders.
Я не говорю, что они не.
I don't mean that they are uneducated, but as far as our ancient history is concerned, which unites all our Russian peoples, I suppose that such kind of educating our leaders, our deputies, is necessary.
You're refining their education. We mustn't forget that Arkaim was discovered at a key moment in modern history. Communism had collapsed, Russian judgment was under fire, an about turn to the West looked to be the nation's only salvation. So to discover evidence of an ancient, sophisticated civilization and one that seemed to have Aryan traits was really too good to be true. Russian pride could be reclaimed. Arkaim became legend almost as soon as it became history. Which was why, although I knew very little about the archaeological digs here, Arkaim's reputation preceded it. Because, and one senses much to Professor Stanovich's dismay, the dig has become a pilgrimage site for Russians in search of an identity. My visit coincided with a summer solstice, and what I witnessed was something the original inhabitants of Arkaim would have recognised, but something... It is very surprising for the 21st century.
Your ears aren't deceiving you. That is indeed the dawn chorus. Only because we're here in southern Siberia, it's a particularly raucous dawn chorus, because I've been staying underneath Ravenswood and the ravens have all just woken up. I'm up this what feels like a rather ungodly hour because it is Midsummer's Day today. And quite rightly, the professor has said that we should go and watch the sunrise over the steppe land from the top of Shamanka, the Shaman's Mountain. What's interesting is that there are lots of people who have already beaten me to it. I can see them up on the brow of the hill, like little ants scurrying over the peak. These are New Agers who've come here to worship the glories of the steppe land in a 21st century kind of way. And of course, that's what's so fascinating about this site, is that it has great antiquity, and yet now it's taken on this second life as a kind of spiritual hotbed of New Agers, of neo-nationalists, who are using the intense symbolism of the ancient past to try to understand their modern world and their future with a kind of prehistoric gloss. Well, I've made it up to the top of the peak, and this is quite some sight. There are hundreds of people up here. Some of the men in military regalia, there are kids wrapped in blankets, very sturdy-looking Russian housewives. And all of them pacing around the top of the hill in a circular motion. In fact, they've walked so many times that the shale up here has formed its own spiral. Right in the middle of the centre of the circle, there's a woman praying in the Orante position with her palms flat and her arms raised up to the sky. There's a kind of intense purposefulness about this event. I don't know what these Russians are here for, but they clearly feel that they can draw something from this experience. And what's interesting is that there are a whole bulk of them on the southern side of the mountain, staring out over that ancient site of Akraim, almost kind of willing it to send some message out to them.
I'd set out on an archaeological trip, but had stumbled into something that felt more akin to sociology.
Why did you go to the top of the hill? Why did you want to experience it?
Because we have some energy here. You can stay in the middle of the circle, put your arms in the top and stay and think about, maybe about God, about everything, and energy will come to you.
And whose energy is it, do you think? Is it the energy of a particular religion, or is it energy from the earth or the sky?
I think from the sky. For me, maybe. Maybe for any people, any things, any parts, but for me, from sky.
And there's a very ancient settlement here. Do you think that's one of the reasons this place feels so special to so many people?
Because everything that a lot of time ago, this interesting for any people. And when you come here, you think maybe you can find something special just for yourself in the place.
And how old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
Сколько вам лет, если можно спросить?
24.
24. So, as a young person, what do you want to take from Arkham back into the modern world?
Наверное, безграничную свободу.
Maybe limitless freedom. Unlimited freedom.
The early risers headed back down to the Arkham Valley to let their hair down at one of the most variegated festivals I have ever, or I suspect will ever, experience.
There is certainly something slightly bizarre about this place. I've just had an extremely large Russian woman in a bright yellow bikini walk past me, and she's been baptising herself in the river, and this is absolutely unexpected. There's a large crowd of Hare Krishna followers who've just turned up.
I
And is there something particularly special about this place? Do you think it has a special spirituality?
Ну, насколько я знаю, то здесь жили древние арии, это
our ancestors, ancient Aryans, lived here, and that's why we are here. And they shared the same belief like us.
Who do you think the Aryans were?
Они были преданными Господу. То есть они были.
They just were devoted to God, and they preached love, celestial love.
Молодую вдову, но она не казачьего роду.
But not all the visitors to Ар-Кайим offered such a benign interpretation of the site's specialness.
People say this is where the Aryans lived in the very distant past. Do you believe that was the case?
Why not? There must be some proof. It's not just me, historians think so too. If you remember Hitler, he was striving to come here because he knew that this was the motherland of the Aryans, and so the place where the whole of mankind was born.
So you must be very proud.
Why can't I be proud? I live here. It's my motherland.
Дорогие друзья, через 15 минут начинается лекция «Тайны Ар-Кайима».
A gentleman in a red checked hoodie and a Kyrgyz hat has just announced through his megaphone that he's doing a lecture on the secrets of Ar-Kayim, and he's gathering quite a crowd. He obviously hopes all of these people here are going to buy his book, which he's produced on the subject, which is laid out on the table in front of his tent. Do you believe it was Aryans who once lived here?
I don't think that these people could be called Aryans. I would call them Slavonic people.
Ар-Кайим – это не один город. Это на самом деле.
The thing is that Ар-Кайим is not just one city. It's a land of a thousand of cities. It covered all the territory of Russia. This very land of thousand cities had its capital city in the center of Russia on the Volga River.
So you believe this was a super civilization?
То есть вы верите, что это была суперцивилизация?
Суперцивилизация.
Yeah, super civilization.
My hooded friend wanted the inhabitants of Ар-Кайим to be Russian Slavs so that he could develop a rhetoric about the future power of the great Russian state. It's a disturbing echo of the way the Nazis distorted prehistory 80 years back. It seems that wherever the Aryans are mentioned, nationalism follows. Today, the ideological baggage of a so-called Aryan super-civilization still weighs heavy. Ar-Kayim is being hijacked by some for political purposes. But although it is not the aboriginal homeland of Proto-Indo-European and therefore a progenitor of civilization itself, it does seem to be a missing link to the cultures that spoke a descendant of that mother tongue. It can also possibly shed some light on the spread of Indo-European languages. Some have thought that the speakers of those languages advanced thanks to violent conquest. Others think Indo-European spread with farming. But the kinds of ritual sacrifice we find plentiful evidence of in Ar-Kayim suggest a more subtle method.
The solution that I've proposed, which I use the American term franchising, basically proposes that the speakers of Proto-Indo-European saw all of the world as being divided into patrons and clients. Their relationships with their gods were the relationships of clients, humans, to the gods who they saw as their patrons. And they addressed requests to the gods in the terms of that a client would use addressing a patron. In other words, I have sworn to you that I will do certain things for you, and you have sworn that you will do certain things for me in return. And these are the kinds of things that are contained in prayers, for instance, in the Rig Veda. That kind of relationship also characterized Indo-European politics, where there were chiefs who were patrons and clients who owed them things. One of the things that chiefs obviously did was provide the animals for public feasts. This is not just a religious festival or ritual, it is also a way of recruiting new people into the system. And the attractive thing about patron-client relationships is that they tend to form strings in which you might be the client of a patron, but he is himself the client of a larger patron, so that you could hope that your children or your grandchildren might someday be patrons themselves. And this is a much more fluid kind of a system, and a system where there's a lot of potential for people at the bottom to move to the top, so that ultimately the original immigrants might become very, very diluted fairly quickly as local people sort of buy into the whole franchising system. And they reproduce the language and the gods and the ceremonies and the feasts and the rituals, but genetically they're a hodgepodge of different people who have been drawn into the system.
You can't but help notice that even modern-day academics explain the spread of Indo-European in terms that make best sense to them and their world. No coincidence that a 21st century American should view it as a form of commercial franchising, because the search for a putative language and the putative people who spoke it is so fraught with difficulty, we all have to use what we do know to try to get closer to what we don't. Which of course can mean that any investigation into Indo-European culture is in danger of starting from a position of bias. There are those who despair of the whole enterprise. Bruce Lincoln.
There wasn't a written language. There is no evidence of a proto-Indo-European language. And there is no evidence of a proto-Indo-European people. There are some graves and some settlements and some bones and objects here, there, and elsewhere. But it's scholars and others using their imagination that says, aha, this was the original site. Armenians tend to put it in Armenia. Northern Indians tend to put it in northern India. Nazis tended to put it, in northern Germany. I understand why they wanted to do that, and it gives me very serious pause. I don't know what is to be gained by saying it's here, there, or elsewhere, when the record of history shows the ways in which that sort of discourse is subject to nationalist, racist, and other dubious uses. And I think the healthy, intellectually and politically healthy position is just to accept uncertainty and to say, this is not a problem we're going to solve.
What we can only hope is that sites such as Ar Kaim do not herald the kind of new Aryan dawn manufactured by the Third Reich in the last century, that the site is allowed to be what it is, a rare window onto a distant Bronze Age past, rather than an excuse for political power play in the future. Listening to the old Soviet songs being sung around the great bonfire here, you're reminded that there are many ghosts here on the steps. There are those who suffered from Aryan ideology, and of course there are those political prisoners, the slaves who shuffled across the steppelands on their way to the notorious gulags. What remains to be seen is whether the ghost of an Indo-European language can be physically raised from the ground from settlements such as Ar Kaim itself. Because here there's a search on to find both the true identity of the inhabitants of the very distant past and a new identity for the inhabitants of a fragile 21st century.
Tracking the Aryans was presented by Bethany Hughes and produced by Russell Finch. It was a Something Else production for BBC Radio 3. And in our feature tomorrow night after the prom, A.L. Kennedy looks at the work and legacy of Scotland's first modern artists, the Glasgow Boys. That's at 9:30 tomorrow evening.
Here on BBC Radio 3, a new season of Monday Lunchtime Concerts, live from Wigmore Hall in London. Top international artists, of course, like the Tokosh Quartet. The singers, Soile Isikoski and Mark Padmore. The instrumentalists, Ilya Gringolds and Sabina Meyer. And chamber music from the Shkampa, Tokyo and Emerson Quartets. The season begins next Monday with a violinist who dazzled audiences at this year's proms, Alina Ibragimova. The BBC Radio 3 Lunchtime Concerts, live from Wigmore Hall in London, Monday lunchtimes at 1 o'clock.
Well, now on BBC Radio 3, with the time approaching 28 minutes to 11, let's hear from another of our new generation artists, the young Danish cellist Andreas Brantelid, who's joined by his regular duo partner, the pianist Bengt Forsberg, in the very first of Beethoven's sonatas for the two instruments. The composer was in his mid-20s when he wrote two sonatas, published as his Opus 5, for Pierre Duport. He was a virtuoso cellist and court musician of Friedrich Wilhelm II, the Prussian king, who had inherited the musical taste of his uncle Frederick the Great and was himself a keen amateur cellist. The first of Beethoven's Opus 5 sonatas is in F major, and it has just two movements, but they make up in virtuosity for what they lack in numbers.